The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 156, Taking Stock of Eugene England's Writings, a panel discussion with Marnie Asplund Campbell, Scott Abbott, and David Barber, with the chair by Tiny Walquist. This is a 60-minute program taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Okay, I want to thank all of you for coming out to Taking Stock of Eugene England's Writings. We have three panelists today. Going first will be Dave Barber. He's graduating in philosophy in just a few weeks, and he's a former religion editor for Student Review, the off-campus newspaper at BYU. And then we'll hear from Scott Abbott, who's an associate editor, or now associate professor of German at Brigham Young University and a member of the BYU chapter of the American Association for University Professors. And then after him, we'll hear from Marnie Asplund Campbell, who is an English teacher living in the Seattle area with three children. And they'll each be taking a certain genre of Jean England's writings. Dave will be talking about his political and social essays. Scott will be talking about his personal essays. And then we'll hear from Marnie, and she'll talk about his literary criticisms. So we'll just start from there. Each person will talk for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we can have some questions from the audience. Okay.
I guess it's a good thing that Gene's not here. It'd be a little too much like the scene in Tom Sawyer where Tom and Huck attend their own funeral. But really, it's not like that. We're just... This is a mid-career evaluation for Gene. I first met Gene England when I was a confused freshman on the first day of class, struggling into the Shakespeare class that he taught in Helaman Halls. Since then, Gene's example and writings have had a profound influence on my life, mostly, I hope, for the good. I think that Gene England's most powerful writings are his most personal, an opinion that is shared by probably most of his readers. That said, I wish to examine here the richness of his social and political writings, writings that are ultimately inseparable from his personal and religious works. The writings in question range from a 1967 dialogue essay on the tragedy of Vietnam and a 1974 essay titled Hanging by a Thread, Mormons and Watergate, to repeated engagements with the problems of war, racism, and sexism in the international arena and in Mormon culture. The political and the social are grounded in the religious. His single most important theme is the love of God as manifest in the atonement, and this theme extends to and forms the basis of his views on social justice. His attitude towards war is not founded on the writings of political theorists, diplomats, and pundits, but on the Sermon on the Mount, the Book of Mormon, and the teachings of Latter-day prophets. For example, he applies the Savior's injunction against thought sin, adultery in the heart, to violence. He applies love your enemies not only to individuals but to nations. Gene is a pacifist, but not a simple pacifist. In an article on Moroni as leader, in a 1977 Ensign article, he draws a few conclusions from the Book of Mormon's accounts of war. Quote, 1. War most often comes to a people because of their unrighteousness and internal dissensions. 2. No matter how it comes, there is no single morally right response to the threat of violence. 3. Even when we take the awesome step of going to war, there are righteous limitations that must be observed. End quote. There is a hint of reticence in this passage. We get the feeling that it isn't all that Gene has to say on the issue. Still, in acknowledging that there is, quote, no single morally right response to the threat of violence, end quote, Gene allows that pacifism might not be the entire answer. Of course, violence is not the entire answer either. Instead, Gene preaches what he calls in another essay, effective pacifism. Quote, we are called on to do whatever we can that will genuinely create peace, even sacrifice our lives, end quote. His opposition to war draws as much on the conservative political tradition as on 1960s anti-war sentiment. He quotes J. Reuben Clark's condemnation of the horrors of the atomic bomb and his declaration that, quote, the church is and must be against war, it cannot regard war as a righteous means of settling international disputes. End quote. But the kind of pacifism that Jean advocates isn't a passive pacifism. He writes approvingly on more than one occasion of the Marshall Plan, an instance in which following the Christian imperative to love one's enemy brought practical benefits of prosperity and friendship to Western Europe. Indeed, trying to follow Christ's imperative led Jean to one celebrated instance of social action, the Food for Poland campaign. Here we see social criticism and action stemming from personal experience and reflection. Jean writes, quote, "On May 13, 1981, in St. Peter's Square in Rome, I was reaching over a barrier to touch the Pope's outstretched hand as he circled through the crowd in his Pope-mobile at the beginning of his weekly public audience. When I saw the bullets hit him, one squarely in the front, below the heart. Though I was momentarily stunned by the sound as well as the sight, three clear impressions came immediately. John Paul II, a great spiritual leader devoted to God, is terribly hurt and will die. Poland's solidarity, to which he gave spiritual authenticity, is finished as a dominant force, at least for a while. And the Soviet KGB is behind this. I was right about the second and third impressions, wrong, I give thanks, about the first." End quote. Jean found himself increasingly obsessed with Poland and the remarkable events of Solidarity's razor-edge persistence. Finding that the Polish people lacked milk for children and the elderly and medicine for the sick, he organized a non-profit effort to send this kind of help to Poland, believing that kindness and humanitarian aid could do what Cold War posturing could not, create an atmosphere of safety in Poland in which the Solidarity movement and democracy could develop. The Food for Poland organization gathered millions of dollars worth of supplies and sent them to Poland, but its efforts were ultimately overshadowed by the Reagan administration's hardline approach to the Polish situation. Now, Jean suggests that we follow the Christian logic of the Marshall Plan and Food for Poland by diverting money from the national defense budget to aid for hungry nations. The arena of international politics is still, for him, an arena where Christ's teachings offer the only hope of salvation. Two other themes that Jean dwells on frequently are racism and sexism. In a Sunstone essay, "Are All Alike Unto God? Prejudice Against Blacks and Women in Mormon Popular Thought," Jean demonstrates his common approach to these two issues. One of his main moves is to show that the theologies that support racism and sexism in Mormon culture are semi-official at best. He then argues from the scriptures and the prophets that racism and sexism, in fact, contradict the truly Mormon and Christian position. This strategy is illustrated in his fascinating account of an interview with Joseph Fielding Smith about blacks in the priesthood, published in 1973. Quote, "In the summer of 1963, agitation about the church's policy of denying the priesthood to black males was at a kind of peak, both nationally and within church circles. I had expressed myself in church situations as not being able to square the curse of Cain or preexistence doctrines with the scriptures, central principles of the restored gospel, or my own best thinking and feeling. I was told bluntly that I could not be a Mormon in good standing without accepting those doctrines. I cared deeply about my standing in the church and relationships with my brothers and sisters, and wasn't about to lead a crusade, and so was ready to seek an authoritative answer. It came to my attention that Joseph Fielding Smith, then president of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, had published an article in the Church News about this matter, and in the process had essentially contradicted one of his assumptions in his earlier discussion of the matter in The Way to Perfection, then calling blacks an inferior race, and now specifically saying that they were not. Two of my friends who were concerned about the same matter, and, as I did, looked at President Smith as the nearly official scriptorian of the church, made an appointment for us to see him. President Smith was not very anxious to see us, since he was being baited from many sources at that time. But after some assurances of our intentions, he gave us some time and was particularly gracious when one of my friends, moved, I think, by the prayer we offered together before going, began the interview by confessing in tears that his original motives for coming had been somewhat contentious. I told President Smith about my experiences with the issue of blacks and the priesthood, and asked him whether I must believe in the preexistence doctrine to have good standing in the church. His answer was, yes, because that is the teaching of the scriptures. I asked President Smith if he would show me the teaching in the scriptures, with some trepidation, because I was convinced that if anyone in the world could show me, he could. He read over with me the modern scriptural sources, and then, after some reflection, said something to me that fully revealed the formidable integrity which characterized his whole life. No, you don't have to believe that Negroes are denied the priesthood because of the preexistence. I have always assumed that because it was what I taught, and it made sense. But you don't have to be in good stand. You don't have to believe it to be in good standing, because it is not definitely stated in the scriptures. And I have received no revelation on the matter. End quote. This passage and this essay have some essential England-esque qualities. Careful phrasing of the issue at hand, thoughtful and personal engagement with the problem, deference to the church and its leaders, a careful distinction between church policy, church doctrine, and what members of the church merely happen to believe. He uses a similar strategy in attacking sexism by examining President Kimball's arguments that Eve is not to be blamed for the fall, and thus that women are not naturally subservient to men. That said, I want to embark on the dangerous path of criticizing Jean England, mostly in the sense of scholarly criticism, but perhaps a little in the everyday sense of criticism. I do this not to detract from his work, but to enhance our understanding of its underlying logic, and I confess that time limitations require that my criticism be roughly sketched in a somewhat hasty manner. Rereading many of Jean's essays for this presentation, I was struck by the feeling of a dichotomy or dualism pervading his writings. On the one hand, a deep and optimistic commitment to the restored gospel. On the other hand, a deep and equally optimistic commitment to humanism and the Western liberal tradition. Examples of this include his reluctance to fully express his pacifism, or his willingness to let the editors mute it, in the previously cited Ensign article, his loyalty to the church even before it granted blacks the priesthood, and his more recent refusal to speculate about the possibility of women receiving the priesthood because, quote, I value my membership in what I believe is Christ's church more than I do my speculations, end quote. This dichotomy also shows through in his offering of religious, pragmatic, and humanistic reasons in support of his political views. It might also be behind what for many of us was a puzzling course of action. Jean's criticizing the church for maintaining secret files on its members and then reversing himself and asking forgiveness when it came out that members of the 12 were responsible for the maintenance of those files. I see humility and submission to the church, but also a conflict between religious and secular values. But isn't the LDS Church, with its progressive theologies of the origin and destiny of humankind and of human agency, its pragmatism and its uniquely American provenance, a church that is uniquely suited to accommodating the humanist ideal? I believe it is, in theology, history, and practice. And this is precisely why Jean has been able to take many of the positions that he has and still remain truly within the bounds of church doctrine. But with many political and social issues, there is a point where humanism and religion part company. Jean told me in an interview published in the Student Review that BYU is trying to do the impossible, quote, to really integrate the faithful pursuit of religion and the serious pursuit of the rational, traditional aims of a university, end quote. In the same way, Jean is trying to do the impossible by reconciling his humanism with his religious faith. As an example of this conflict, I want to read his writings on racism together with his much briefer writings on homosexuality. The parallel occurred to me earlier this year when two theologians, Linda Thomas and Dwight Hopkins, spoke at BYU on womanist and black theologies. In the course of their presentations, both Thomas and Hopkins, who are black, spoke of the need for inclusivity in Christ's gospel, mentioning lesbians and gay men as being among those groups that are traditionally excluded, but that Christian love demands be included and aided towards liberation. In their replies to these presentations, Valerie Hudson, a BYU professor of political science, and Jean England mentioned these pleas for inclusivity, but both left out homosexuals in their own litany of groups that need more love from the Christian community. Certainly the politics of speaking at BYU were partly responsible for this loud omission, and I am not suggesting that either Hudson or Jean feels anything but Christian love towards homosexuals. But there seems to be a breakdown in Jean's logic here, failing to see what for Thomas and Hopkins is a definite parallel between the liberation of blacks, the liberation of women, and the liberation of gays and lesbians. Consider first a statement by Jean on diversity. Quote, "We Mormons are among those God has been patient with in the time of our ignorance, but who are now called to repent and join in God's delight in the diversity of his creation." End quote. Now here is an excerpt from a 1987 letter to Dialogue about homosexuality. Quote, "It seems to me that the proper model for Mormons is to hold firmly to the law of married fidelity, which suggests that a heterosexual bipolar union of a man and a woman is what makes possible not only the creation of mortal bodies on earth, but also is necessary for the creation of spirit children and new universes, a continuation of the seeds forever in the fullest expression of self and relationship possible, what we call godhood. Mormons should make no judgments about homosexual feelings, but the overwhelming evidence of the scriptures and modern revelation, and, I think, common sense, is that though perhaps 10% of men and a lesser number of women are affected by the genetic and embryonic forces that produce homosexuality, it is not an eternal condition or a viable alternative to celestial marriage as the supreme basis for divine self-fulfillment and creativity." End quote. In this passage, Jean is firmly in line with an Orthodox LDS position about homosexuality, and in fact is fairly progressive in an LDS context in his insistence on a distinction between homosexual feelings and behavior, and later in the letter in insisting on compassion towards homosexuals. But part of what is going on here sounds to me exactly like the semi-official theorizing about the curse of Cain, or the curse of Eve, that Jean denounces in the context of debunking racism and sexism. In the absence of explicit revelation from the Church on the subject, Jean is offering his own best guesses at a theological underpinning for current Church policy, a policy that is at least partly and perhaps wholly based on popular, non-revealed cultural prejudices. Jean writes, quote, "It is more reasonable as well as ethical to give up racist and sexist theology than to cling to every statement by every Church leader as authoritative," end quote. But apparently it is not more reasonable to give up heterosexist theology rather than cling to theological speculations that deny religious sanction to the love of millions of God's children. There seem to be several conflicts here. One is between Jean's approach to racism and sexism and his approach to homosexuality. Another is between today's liberal humanist orthodoxy of accepting and sanctioning homosexual behavior and the Church's firm stand against such behavior. However, this second conflict points to an underlying consistency in Jean's approach to these issues. The 1973 Pre-Priesthood Declaration essay I've been citing about blacks and the priesthood is called The Mormon Cross. It talks about the Church's policy of denying blacks the priesthood as a cross for members to bear until God finds the Church sufficiently free of prejudice and grants blacks the priesthood. While critical of folk theologies about black people, Jean is supportive of the Church and never hints that its policy should be changed by anything but revelation. In a striking similarity, Jean refers to homosexuality as a cross that some people must bear in this lifetime, a cross no worse than other problems that people learn to live with. Again, Jean is fundamentally supportive of the Church's position, although this time he does not see a possibility for change. We see that Jean may sometimes be uneasy with conflicts between humanism and religion, but that he generally sticks with religion when such a conflict arises. In some cases, his rational humanism helps him see the prejudices of his religious culture and find a more ethical religious response to these prejudices. To a certain extent, this is also true of Jean's compassionate attitude towards gays and lesbians. However, it seems to me that in this case, he abandons his humanist tools too early, remaining satisfied that the exclusive heterosexuality that LDS culture preaches is in fact the only form of sexuality acceptable to God. Despite what I believe is a deeply rooted conflict in Jean's writings, he consistently holds both himself and his fellow saints to a higher standard than the one they are living. He decries our militarism, materialism, and fear of diversity, often echoing Brigham Young, President Kimball's powerful essay, The False Gods We Worship, and the warnings of Lowell Banion and Hugh Nibley. For example, Jean writes, quote, "It is humiliating evidence that Utah, with its huge Latter-day Saint majority, is indeed by many relevant measures the worst state in the worst nation for uninhibited greed and inequality, militarism, and disrespect for animal and plant life, or even its own originally God-inspired architectural heritage and civic environments," end quote. Or, directing criticism against himself in a sharply personal tone, quote, In the past 10 years, I have become increasingly unsure about the value and satisfactions of my traditional male role as aggressive achiever, doer, decider, spokesman, which, for all my achievements, has left me lonely and defensive, in some ways emotionally immature." End quote. I believe that part of Gene's dichotomy between humanism and religion is resolved by his commitment to diversity and dialogue. This commitment is at once humanist and deeply religious. Quote, "I do not believe Christ can come again until, like him, we have no respect of persons, until for us as well as for our God, all are alike, black and white, male and female. But my main reason for thinking so is not social, but personal. I believe our individual salvation, at the very deepest level, is tied to this principle." End quote. This imperative of diversity is behind Gene's classic essay, On Saving the Constitution, or Why Some Utah Mormons Should Become Democrats, in which he anticipates Elder Jensen in arguing that the Republicans in Utah, quote, "are developing the attitudes and practices of one-party rule. These attitudes and practices are much more dangerous than the particular beliefs or programs of either party." End quote. Gene admits that he's not always right. Thus, if he misjudges the balance between religious and humanist ideals, someone else can come along and correct him. He asks himself, quote, "Are you suggesting that what you have said in this essay, despite your very best efforts to speak the truth, is surely a little and might be a lot wrong, that it ought to be argued with and modified? Yes, you've got it. That's exactly what I'm saying." End quote. He once related a quote from Joseph Smith to our Shakespeare class, "In proving two contraries, the truth is made manifest." Gene believes in the American ideal of truth emerging from a clamor of diverse voices. But I want to suggest a further grounding of this ethic of dialogue and a further way in which Gene makes the dichotomies and contradictions in his own and others' views less problematic. Several times in his writings, Gene is deeply moved by Hugh Nibley's summing up of his life experiences in the simple words, "Repent and forgive, repent and forgive." In closing, I suggest that the love of God as manifest in the atonement lies behind all of Gene's strivings for humility and non-judgmental love. This love takes away the enmity of differing viewpoints, allowing a charitable suspension of prejudice and compassion for suffering that brings people together despite their differences. I believe that this accounts for the great care with which Gene expresses himself in various public situations. He believes that, quote, "a dialogue can realize its full possibilities only if there is charity, if we speak with sensitivity to each other's framework or ability to hear, and speak in order to communicate for each other's welfare, not to justify or exalt ourselves at each other's expense." End quote. The political has returned to the religious. I end with a moving passage from a talk that I heard Gene give in Las Vegas at a gathering of saints opposed to nuclear testing, an expression of Gene's deep social conscience and abiding faith in God. "If we come fasting, humble, fragile, peaceful, God can take away the leanness in our souls. He can help us build up the old waste places, the mines and test caves and missile silos where we have violated our Mother Earth. We can raise up the foundation of many generations of our children, living in peace with each other and the land. We can repair the breaches between peoples and nations, between races and sexes, between ourselves and the environment. We can be the restorer of paths to dwell in, and find at the end of them the footstep of our God, not the cave of death in the desert, but the field of sago lilies." Thank you.
Differences between Dave and me may be summed up well in a pair of reading glasses. Most of you know that Tara and Dave are involved in publishing the Student Review, which is a crucial organ for free speech at BYU. And all of us who work at BYU, well, many of us who work at BYU are grateful to them for this. All right. Maybe I'm taller than Dave is, too. Older and taller. Many of you will have heard the story of J. Golden Kimball as a member of the Salt Lake County Irrigation Board. A more senior church official was also a member of that irrigation board. Discussion turned to a possible bridge over the Jordan River. "We don't need a bridge over the Jordan River, Kimball said. "I can piss halfway across the Jordan River." "Golden," the more senior church official said, you're out of order. I know I'm out of order, Kimball said. When I was in order, I could piss all the way across the Jordan River. This story appears in a book about Kimball written by a BYU professor of English. As the book was printed originally by BYU University Press, there were several similar stories, one of them involving a church president who was relieving himself. The president of BYU at that time, when he saw the newly printed book, is reported to have said, "We will not have presidents of the church pissing in books printed by BYU Press." The edition was destroyed, and a new version printed, in which J. Golden Kimball, but not the president, is allowed to be J. Golden Kimball. Fortunately, and here I get to my point, Gene England is not a church president. Consider the following shocking scene in Gene's fine essay, Monte Cristo, A Meditation on Learning to Fly Fish, an essay so full of fishing lore and wildflowers and sensuous pleasures that it rivals Norman MacLean's fine A River Runs Through It. So this is Gene. "I suddenly realized I had for some time needed to urinate, but had put it off, driven by the excitement of fishing and the job of preparing the fire and the fish. Now I felt the need intensely, from my belly down through my thighs. I moved over to some low elderberry bushes that hid me from Frank, opened my fly, and let loose with great pleasure. Just as I did so, a hummingbird whirred up the river and hovered directly in front of me, facing me so close I could see glints in his carmine throat and on the heart-shaped inside of the tail that bobbed up and down to give him stability, black-tipped feathers with an inner ring of white. I stared back at him from a foot away, startled out of time. His head remained perfectly still, his eyes fixed on me in the midst of the whirring wings and bobbing tail. Then I realized he had mistaken my father's special fly on my vest for a strange new red-spotted flower. After a moment, showering glints of green from his back, he whirred off so fast his wings made a small rattle." That's from Making Peace, personal essay. Gene has written a lot of personal essays, some, like Monte Cristo, more personal than others, and he has thought about the genre itself. He says, "I do not presume to provide a theology of mercy or even a full description of its qualities and expressions. I believe that something so essential and rich as the quality of mercy can only be approached in a variety of ways. I wish not to dissect it nor to pretend fully to encompass it, but to see and rejoice in its many facets. Throughout this book, I constantly bear witness through my personal experience. Personal essays seem to me particularly appropriate to a discussion of mercy, because one of the central qualities of mercy is that it requires us to open our most tender and vulnerable parts, our very hearts, to others and to Christ. Gene's book Dialogues with Myself, Personal Essays on Mormon Experience, likewise theorizes, as it begins, on the nature of the personal essay. And in keeping with its title, idea of dialogue, has as its epigraph a dialectical statement by Joseph Smith, which Dave has already quoted, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest." As Gene writes his personal essays, as he works in the essay form, he is employing a genre with a history. Many agree that the 16th century French essayist Montaigne was the master of the form, whose name we sometimes use as a verb, like in, we say, "I'd like to essay an opinion," in which means, the word essay means to try, to experiment, to attempt. In an essay called The Essay as Form, another brilliant essayist, the 20th century German Theodor Adorno, suggests several characteristics of the essay that seem applicable to Gene's writing. Consider the following excerpts that appear in the context of Adorno's ongoing attack on the dogmatic identity thinking of post-Enlightenment scientific thought. So this is a series of quotations from that essay. "The essay as a form rebels against the doctrine, deeply rooted since Plato, that what is transient and ephemeral is unworthy of philosophy. The customary objection that the essay is fragmentary and contingent itself postulates that totality is given, and with it the identity of subject and object, and acts as though one were in possession of the whole. The essay's weakness bears witness to the very non-identity it expresses. In the emphatic essay, thought divests itself of the traditional idea of truth. Thought does not progress in a single direction. Instead, the moments are interwoven as in a carpet. The fruitfulness of the thoughts depends on the density of the texture. And he's playing with that word texture and weaving and text, right? A text is something which is woven as well. This kind of learning remains vulnerable to error, as does the essayist's form. It has to pay for its affinity with intellectual experience with a lack of security that the norm of established thought fears like death. I'm going to stop here and just say how sad we are that Gene is no longer teaching at BYU, because the norm of established thought fears the experience, the affinity with open intellectual experience like death. Then a final statement by Adorno. The daring, anticipatory, and not fully redeemed aspect of every essayistic detail attracts other such details as its negation. The untruth in which the essay knowingly entangles itself is the element in which its truth resides. I had no idea that Dave was going to take Gene to task for something Gene had said, but I think he's proven exactly what Adorno is claiming. Gene has been brave enough to put his thoughts on paper and to make arguments, knowing, as I know, as I'm saying these things, and as you know, as you write whatever you write, that we're making mistakes, and that we don't understand everything, and that somebody is going to come along and rub our nose in what we've just said. That's good. All right. I'll come back to several of these points as I talk about two of Gene's essays that I find especially meaningful, both generically and personally. The first is called Enduring and was published initially in Dialogue in 1983. The essay begins with the sentence, "I grew up in a safe valley." The essay's second paragraph continues the theme of safety but introduces a new theme. "Even when I found a perfect flint arrowhead and a large flawed spearhead on one of those picnics, I did not imagine the blood." What Gene will ask of his readers as they read on is to imagine blood, to imagine a universe of pain and genetic defect and crushing debt and misplaced faith and lost life, and all this in the context of an overwhelming need and desire for safety. If any of you have read the book that Marnie edited called With Child, and that several of you have essays in, it's the kind of book that Gene's essay is. It's people writing about the problems they have with their children and about their children's problems. And like Gene's essay, that's a set of extraordinary essays, I think. So Gene is going to ask us to look at pain and defect in the context of an overwhelming need and desire for safety. Gene prefaces Enduring with a statement by Edgar to Gloucester in King Lear. "Men must endure their going hence, even as their coming hither." I read that poorly. "Men must endure their going hence, even as their coming hither." This dialectical assertion hinges on the word even, a word Gene repeats, you will remember, in slightly different form in that fine sentence, "even when I found a perfect flint arrowhead and a large flawed spearhead I did not imagine." Follows is rife with hinges, like that word even, conjunctions like and, but, and or, dialectical hinges that allow an essay to approach life rather than totalize it, to approximate rather than to abstract, to offer the transient and ephemeral, where a short circuit to the absolute would be easier and perhaps more comforting, if ultimately devastating. Let me give a single example. Note the turn between paragraphs, from surest faith to despair. And this is still from that essay, Enduring. My father asked me to kneel with him, and he spoke, I thought, to Christ about the wheat. He pledged again, as I had heard him at home, to give all the crop, all beyond our bare needs, to build a kingdom. And he claimed protection from drought and hail and wind. I felt, beside and in me, something, a person, it seemed, something more real than the wheat or the ridge or the sun, something warm like the sun, but warm inside my head and chest and bones, something like us, but strange, thrilling, fearful, but safe. But one evening there began to come moments when I could feel moving into my mind like a physical presence, the conviction that all was quite absurd. It made no sense at all that anything should exist. This essay allows itself, forces itself, to move between these two poles, gazing unflinchingly at the horror of genetic defects and cancer, and doing so not in the context of miraculous healings, but of promised healing that did not occur. A double blow. I don't want to say much more about enduring other than to note that in a series of fragments, in a sequence of anecdotes, you remember what Adorno said about the fragmentary nature of the essay, Jean forgoes a sermon and suggests, by example only and never by exhortation, that an answer to the dilemma, one answer, not an answer really, but a shifting of the question, might be found in action, in service, in productive movement, in essaying, attempting. And Dave read that section about seeing the Pope get shot and then Jean's work with Food for Poland. That's the kinds of actions that appear in that essay then, as suggestions. Okay, there is the horror. I'm not going to paper it over, but maybe we can do something for someone. And there are lots of things we can't do as well. It's a complicated essay, and I think the fact that he trusts us as readers to put it together and to make our sense out of it rather than giving us summarizing sermons gives it its strength. Easter Weekend, Dialogue 1988, is the second essay I'd like to comment on. I'm drawn to it, I think, for the same reasons I like Enduring. It begins with questions. It undermines its own authority. It works by juxtaposition rather than by iron logic. And is fruitful, as Adorno says, because of the density of its texture. Jean reveals first, in a finely drawn scene, that he is an easy mark, that it is precisely his own sense for his own intelligence that makes him easy prey for a trio of confidence men who take him on the New York streets for $120. That's almost all he's got, and then he's trying to make do with the money he's got in the rest of his trip. Then my favorite scene, the next scene, related to the first and only by its proximity, further intensifies the questions of just what good intelligence, talent, literary acumen, and all the rest are. I watched a lady across the table in a print dress and an imitation fur-collared coat, which she kept pertly buttoned. She had notebooks and folders full of bills and receipts and lists and slips that she kept shuffling and restacking and poring over and making new lists from. At first I thought she was balancing her checkbook, but she kept going over the same things, shifting in her chair, restacking the lists, sighing, copying new figures, pursing her lips, returning to the notebooks and then the slips of paper, erasing, writing, always intent. I couldn't tell what it was. I had to stop watching. I'm going to read it again, and as I read it, I'd like you to think of it as an essay about the essay. I watched the lady across the table in a print dress and an imitation fur-collared coat, which she kept poorly buttoned. She had notebooks and folders full of bills and receipts and lists and slips that she kept shuffling and restacking and poring over and making new lists from. At first I thought she was balancing her checkbook, but she kept going over the same things, shifting in her chair, restacking the lists, sighing, copying new figures, pursing her lips, returning to the notebooks and then the slips of paper, erasing, writing, always intent. I couldn't tell what it was. I had to stop watching. I haven't read many people who are willing to face the possible meaningless and horror of their whole life with the strength that Jean has just done it in that. Or maybe I'm reading it wrong. That's possible, too. Easter weekend continues with a rich tapestry of stories about fishing, near death, Shakespeare scholarship, and personal weakness. One motif, however, kept catching my eye. And as Jean is willing to flick this motif over me, as he would a fly with his fly rod, repeatedly, delicately, trusting in my ability as a reader, he allows me the delight to delight in my discovery, and finally, perhaps, to be reeled in. I'm talking about the recurring motif of the theater of the confidence game, the actual theater where he sees a Sam Shepard play, the Manhattan LDS wardhouse that has been converted into that very theater, the Montreal Church on Good Friday as theater, complete with a trumpet player who reminds Jean of one of the con men, the theater where he sees Hamlet, the art museum as theater with the painting Dead Christ with Angels, and finally the new Manhattan Ward building, now definitely not a theater, but part of a church office building. The implications of this chain of motifs are complex. It can be read as harsh self-criticism, as images of despair, as flawed but continuing attempts at meaning, as a construction of false meaning, as criticism of a church that leaves the theater for the business world, as a subversion of that perversion by an immigrant who begins a new play with the words, and these are the words the essay ends with, "I'm sorry in all the world." Finally, so as not to become a maudlin hagiographer, I'd like to point out just how naive and misguided Jean can be as an essayist. I'm thinking about his essay, which Dave already cited, "Why Utah Mormons Should Become Democrats." Jean is taking what he thinks is a dialectical position, arguing for balance and dialogue. He says he has been a lifelong Republican, that he voted twice for Nixon and twice for Reagan. But we need a two-party system in Utah, he says, and so some of us ought to become Democrats. So what's wrong with this? Dave liked it. It reveals Jean as politically naive, as misguided, as a member of a political party whose representatives include Newt Gingrich, Chris Cannon, Jim Hansen, and Orrin Hatch. The argument, Jean, ought to be, Utahns ought to become Democrats because of the Democratic support of the poor, their environmental consciousness, and so forth.
I'm going to try to abbreviate just a bit so that we can talk. We've been talking a lot about Jean's personal self, I think because we all know him as a personal self. But also it's significant to me that we've arrived at many of the same conclusions, the greatest of which is that there's a tremendous sense of enigma and dichotomy in what we understand as Jean England, not just the man, but also his work. Literary scholars tend to deal with issues of text and identity, text and society, the individual creator of text and society. And, I mean, I hesitate even to make these statements because there are so many scholars who will decry even the identifying of what it is that literature does or what it is that a literary critic should do. But one notable critic, and an influential one, described the history of the development of literature as hanging on what he called the anxiety of influence. That influential, talented writers, male writers primarily, perceive the writers who have preceded them and feel, in a sense, like Oedipus, that they have to undertake to somehow murder their predecessors in order to come into their own as writers. And that's one way that a literary scholar has looked at what it is that literature means to a society. taking a different bent, Gene, I think, and what I think is remarkable about his work as a literary scholar is that he abandons that anxiety. He is completely willing and able and happy to embrace any number of... Sergeant Pepper's is one of the first pieces of music as a whole that I remember hearing as a child. My parents had the album. I remember it playing in the house. I remember looking at the album cover and being kind of bewildered by the bizarre pictures and things and putting on my arm and flapping it like wings and stuff like that. So it has a very large place in my consciousness, that music. And to be a mother and have my children listening to that music and somehow identifying with it and it becoming part of their language brought, first of all, to my mind the sense of tremendous continuity, thanks to the Beatles. But also what struck me was the shift in technology. You know, as a child, we had a record player and there was a needle, and I had to sit in my parents' living room to listen to the music. Now we're in a car, and we're driving through a mountain pass, and we have this little, I don't know how they work, a little crystal disc or whatever's on it, stuck in this machine that sucks it in and spits out this music. And what's so I was struck by this sense of the shift in technology enabling this identical message to somehow become meaningful in a completely different and new context for my children. And that's where I'm going to start in talking about Gene as a literary critic, believe it or not. What Eugene England has done as a scholar and critic of Mormon literature is to embrace the tremendous diversity of what we think of as text and of literary text and to give it a place to exist and to grow. I looked at some of his earliest work, and this is the essay, I believe it's in the first issue of Dialogue, called The Possibility of Dialogue. And in here we see, again, Gene's openness, and yet contained in this title and in the very heart of this essay, The Possibility of Dialogue, is both a tremendous optimism and a tremendous pessimism. The fact that he's saying there is a possibility to have a dialogue, and he's talking about a dialogue about truth. He includes the quote from the New Testament, prove all things, hold fast to that which is good. And he goes on and says that as Mormons, as contemporary Mormons, we need to both follow and pursue truth with a degree of skepticism, but also with a degree of faith. So here we see Gene both admitting there is no dialogue right now, but also saying there possibly could be a dialogue at some point. He talks about this balance between contemporary skepticism and the need which he sees to establish, first of all, and this is what he says we need as Mormons, both in a literary and non-literary context, to establish some initial commitment to values, to some beliefs that give a person a place from which to speak, and a purpose for speaking. So on one hand, again, there's this dichotomy. He says that Mormon literature in some ways has to have a central thread or element of a commitment to the gospel and to being Mormons. But at the same time, he's also pushing the limits here a little bit and saying later on in the essay, a dialogue is possible if, in trying to describe our findings and convictions, we can be honest with ourselves and each other, if we can use traditional forms and conventions without letting them become lies or idols. And Gene, in my experience as a literary critic and scholar in a variety of contexts that I've known him, is tremendously committed to literary form. And we've had endless arguments about the values of a sonnet versus free verse. And he continues, I think, to be fairly committed to poetic form, for example, as being a kind of a requirement for really skillful work to be crafted. Anthologizing, I think, is the gift that Gene has as a scholar. And in creating anthologies, I believe that what he's done is to create a place where Mormon literature can happen. This is a quote from the editor's commentary to the book of poetry called Harvest that he helped to anthologize. He says, "Poetry is one of the arts of time as well as of language. Like music, it depends for its finest and fullest achievement on clear and subtle use of various kinds of rhythm, repetition and variation over time, of exact or similar stresses, silences, and phrases. Like prose, it is words and therefore deals in concepts, ideas, and moral values as well as sounds. It has content as well as form. So here we see again Jean pushing a little bit that we do need to have some sense of form. But he goes on and says, Mormon poets, probably because of their religious beliefs and experience, tend to emphasize content over form. And then later in that same essay, he says, during the last century, poets have lost confidence in the traditional forms that were developed precisely to give language power to define the world in a systematic way. Increasingly, poetic form has become merely a demanding game to play with sounds and feelings, rather than, as it was for Chaucer and Shakespeare, and still to some extent for Keats, an objective means of expressing meaning. And if you read Jean's poetry, you'll find that he does try attempt to adhere to form. So he enters into this discussion of what makes Mormon literature Mormon literature. And I'm going to move now to his introductory essay to the collection of writings about Mormon literature, Tending the Garden, that Jean wrote, where he refers to the sort of conflict that he identifies as with Richard Craycroft and Bruce Jorgensen, who wrote essays in Sunstone about what Mormon literature is. Richard Craycroft, Jean says, who could be called the father of modern Mormon literary studies for his pioneering work in the early 1970s in producing the first anthologies and starting the first Mormon literature classes, has strongly objected to the recent directions in most Mormon literature as being too imitative of flawed contemporary critical and moral trends, and thus untrue to Mormon traditions and values. So in other words, Richard Craycroft feels like if it's not Mormon, if it doesn't inherently display somehow Mormon values, it really isn't worthy to be called Mormon literature, a view which is increasingly being promoted in the BYU English department right now. Bruce Jorgensen, on the other hand, says Mormon literature should be distinguished not so much by specific doctrinal content and didactic purposes as by its powerfully conveyed love of the world God has given us, and by its unusual hospitality to diversity of both content and style. Jean then goes on to consider what I think is a very sophisticated and very unusual consideration of language and linguistics. He talks about Mormon writers then have at hand sufficient matter with which to produce a great literature, which is the question which he continually addresses. But does Mormonism also provide insight into the resources and limitations of the means of literature, language, form, style, genres, and critical perspectives? So he considers a little bit what access we have to language and looks at how we as Mormons both adhere to a sort of nominal sense of language but also a very literal sense of language. And these are important questions when we consider someone like Brian Evanson, whose work, heavily Mormon-themed, may seem to violate some of the values that Mormons hold. And again, I think what I want to finally end up with is that Jean does not attempt to answer these questions. And he, as Scott said so wonderfully, obviously knows that whatever he says he's going to be wrong about. But what Jean did, which is so remarkable and relates to my story about Sergeant Peppers, was that he made a journal. He made a place. And whatever we want to say about the means of literature, whatever form or whatever style it takes, I think more importantly, we have to have a place for it to happen, and that's what he provided. And I remember as a very young girl sitting and reading dialogue and reading a short story by Doug Thayer about a depressed Vietnam veteran suffering and struggling with his faith and being completely blown away by that and never knowing that I could take... Shoot, my mom shouldn't be in the front row. She's going to make me cry. That I could take my beliefs and what seemed to me as a very private and insular world and somehow integrate it with what I felt growing in me, which was a desire to write. But in providing the place, I think that Jean in some ways freezes up and eradicates the need to make these distinctions, whether it's Mormon or whether it's not. There's a place for it to happen. And in some ways, I think that's the most powerful thing that he accomplished. He refers to Carl Keller's identifying Mormon literature as what he calls jack fiction. I want to add to that our current in the circle of friends and writers, we refer to that as post-Mormon literature. And this becomes a really important question, you know, that so many Mormon writers leave the church in order to become fulfilled and complete writers. So many Mormon writers who want to stay in the church and write Mormon literature wind up producing work which we feel is artless or not true literature. And again, I believe that what Jean England has done in many of his writings and in his anthologizing is to remind us that in some ways those distinctions are arbitrary and in fact destructive to the full flowering of the art which can be created. As a final thought, I want to refer to in his description of what he calls the period of 1880 to 1930, which he refers to as the period of home literature in Mormon literature, he says that this movement in literature came about when Orson F. Whitney declared that the second generation of Mormon youth did not have the powerful pioneer experiences that drew them to the church, that they were straying, and that we needed to establish a kind of literature which would once again compel people to return to the church. And I think that's another powerful thing that Jean did, is he identified that the literature that was produced by those people was largely related to the needs of that group at that time. And again, Jean is willing to acknowledge that in the contemporary church that we have right now, we have very specific needs, and that the literature that we're evolving addresses those needs. Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for coming to the session and thank the participants for preparing their papers. And I also want to make a little plug. This is the student review issue that came out in April, and it's in honor of Jean England's retirement. And it has lots of tributes written by faculty members and students and friends of Jean, and it has a reprint of one of his essays and an interview with him. So, and there's a stack right outside the door, and they're free. Feel free to pick them up and take them home and share them with your friends. Thanks for coming.